Thank you very much, Tony, for your introduction. And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. A pleasure to be here in this very splendid structure in Melbourne and to talk to you about the road to prosperity. I rather like the title of the conference, The Road to Recovery, as it's one that I used myself in a talk some months ago. When I spoke in April about the road to recovery, the question was how to get onto that road. And it was clear at that point that the global financial system had been stabilized by the extraordinary actions of policymakers in the last few months of last year. So the financial system very gradually was mending. It was also clear at that time, though, that the major countries had experienced a very sharp contraction in aggregate demand in the December quarter and in the March quarter. And it wasn't clear then whether that slide had been arrested. We now know that it was bottoming out. But at that point, reputable observers were talking about the worst global recession since the 1930s. Certainly for some of the major countries at that time, there seemed to be some evidence for that view, and indeed, in some respects, there still does. It was widely thought at that time that Australia would be affected by these events. Even if you were optimistic about Australia in a relative sense, as I was, it was hard to see how we could escape having a significant impact of such an international downturn. And to say that Australia would do relatively well, although that's accurate, maybe didn't reassure people all that much, because the conditions in so many other countries seemed just so bad. Well, as it turns out, in April, or thereabouts, we were pretty much at the nadir of sentiment about prospects for the Australian economy. 6 or 7 months later, I think even most of the optimists are probably a little surprised at the economy's performance. So the title of the conference is particularly apt, I think. But the issue before us is not, in fact, how to get onto the road to recovery, because we're on that road. The question, rather, I think, is how to make sure that the road to recovery connects to the road to prosperity. To make that connection, I want to offer the suggestion that we need to do two things. First, we need to learn the correct lessons from our experience of the past couple of years. And there are no doubt many lessons to which people would point, and I'm only going to point out just a few. And then secondly, we need to apply those lessons in the right way to the challenges that lie ahead, and I'll offer one or two observations about that. So the lessons from the crisis. The first lesson is that the business cycle still exists, and that financial behaviour matters, and sometimes it matters a lot to how that cycle unfolds. We need, in fact, to have a broad definition of what we mean by a business cycle. Not just the cycle in real GDP and employment and unemployment and CPI inflation and those things, they remain important, but equally important is the need to recognise the cycle in risk-taking and financial behaviour. And failing to do that, of course, is exactly what got some countries into so much trouble in this episode. For some years, we heard talk of the Great Moderation, so-called, a reference to a period of unusually low macroeconomic volatility for the major countries that went from around the middle of the 1980s until quite recently. During that period, the United States, to take just one, had a couple of recessions, but they were fairly shallow ones. Inflation in most countries was low and stable. So were interest rates. And Australia shared in that experience from about the mid-1990s on with an unusually long economic expansion. compared with the instability of the 1970s and 80s and early 80s, that was a remarkably good performance, macroeconomically speaking. It was also very positive for quite some time for investment returns. But the problem with that apparently benign environment was, I think, that it made things seem just a little too easy. As that period of stability grew longer, so compensation for risk tended to diminish as investors continued their search for yield. In the end, that search explored some very remote or even unknown territory, including complex structured products, exotic derivatives, and so on. Key sectors of important economies accumulated quite a lot of leverage along the way, either in households or financial institutions or both. In other words, as the macroeconomic environment seemed to become less risky, people changed their behaviour. That macro stability provided scope, it seems, for financial trends to go further than they might otherwise have done, and really further than they should have done. Ultimately, that reintroduced risk through another channel. The financial structure of economies changed in a way that was more likely to amplify certain types of shocks once they occurred. Well, the great moderation has ended for many of the world's most advanced economies. They've become reacquainted with the business cycle in its most unstable and unpredictable form, where financial shocks and real economic activity become highly, even dangerously, connected through balance sheets. So it's an old lesson, but one worth restating. No country has managed to eliminate the business cycle. No country ever will, because the cycle is driven by human psychology, which finds expression in financial behaviour as well as in so-called real behaviour. We're seemingly just made, or hardwired, if you will, in a way that makes us prone to bouts of optimism and pessimism, prone to periods of myopic disregard for risk, followed in short order by total unwillingness almost to accept risk of any kind. Now, we could search for perfect policies that will eliminate that or offset it, but that search would most likely, I think, continue to be frustrating and ultimately fruitless. So realistically, what we need are policy frameworks which recognise that cycle in its inevitability and yet unforecastability and help us cope with it. And they will do that in large part by limiting the build-up of excesses during the good times. Australia's policy frameworks, I think, have withstood the test pretty well in this period. Nonetheless, they will need ongoing investment if they're to continue to work well in the future. And even the best policy frameworks cannot make the cycle go away. We need a parallel development in the general public discussion of economic and financial cycles. And we might start, I think, with a more balanced discourse about recessions. Now, we're still debating, I guess, whether the events of late last year and early this year should be labelled a recession or not. And the fact that we're still debating that says something good about the severity of the episode. Well, maybe we should just let the students of economic history decide what label to apply and focus on a broader issue. If it was a recession, then it was the eighth one since World War II. It certainly won't be the last one. Recessions are cyclical events which occur periodically, but not with sufficient regularity to be forecastable, at least as far as timing is concerned. They will occur in future. And if one's business or personal or policy strategy depends on a cyclical downturn not occurring, then it is a very risky one. So the road to prosperity is not, a road without cyclical ups and downs. But the second lesson we ought to draw from the recent experience is that when, even though downturns inevitably will occur, we're not helpless to do anything about their severity. We can make a difference. When a downturn came to Australia this time, certainly there were casualties. Risky business strategies, which usually were related to financial structure, were exposed, and those involved suffered losses. Other firms and individuals suffered more difficult circumstances too, and many still are. But on the best reading of all the information we have at present, this appears to have been one of the mildest downturns we've had. It's likely, furthermore, that recovery is already underway, and that's the next lesson. When a downturn comes, we can recover. Now, the relative resilience pardon me, of the economy in this cycle, I think, warrants some discussion. Unless we're prepared to accept that it was all an incredible coincidence, we have to ask, how is it that things turned out that way? It wasn't just that China quickly returned to growth, even though that was important for sustaining export volumes, and it was important for re-establishing confidence in the outlook for the resource sector, which did actually wobble for a few months. But China's importance may well be greater for future outcomes than recent past ones. Equally important recently were other factors, including the relative strength and resilience of the economy and the financial sector, and the willingness and the scope to change macroeconomic policy. Those things were not accidents. Financial resilience resulted from sensible management by the financial institutions themselves and careful regulation on the part of the prudential supervisor. For the most part, the non-financial part of the economy, the corporate sector, was also pretty conservatively managed, at least as far as their balance sheet was concerned. And that's because there are still many managers and directors who remember a time when that wasn't so. Moreover, businesses took a far-sighted view, as we know, on employment decisions. Given the preceding difficulties in securing labour in the boom, they found ways of keeping people on payrolls, even if that meant at reduced hours. They clearly had not only the good sense, but also the requisite institutional flexibility to be able to do that. That must say something about the progress that's been made over 20 years or more in labour market arrangements. And finally, long-term investments in prudent fiscal and monetary policy frameworks paid off. A whole generation of policymakers painstakingly worked to build credibility by taking decisions with a long-run perspective. And the return to that was in the form of a capacity to respond credibly to the downturn before it gathered much momentum. So the lesson here is that all those investments were worthwhile. I think, therefore, that this episode offers us an opportunity to revisit our national script about recessions and recoveries, about financial behaviour and about policy frameworks. Recessions will occur, as they always have. Financial behaviour matters greatly and can, if we're not careful, contribute to instability. In our thinking, we need to remember that about the future. But if we do remember it, and if we act with due prudence during the upswings, recessions need not be bad ones, and when they come, we can recover. Signposts to that effect ought to be erected along the road to prosperity. Let me turn then to applying these lessons. The task before us now is to manage a new expansion. Of course, we are still in that period where we can't be absolutely certain that the expansion will gather full momentum. Every upswing starts with that uncertainty. The conduct of macroeconomic policies in the near term must grapple with that uncertainty, as it always must. Even so, it's not too early to think about issues of a medium-term nature. And here, for me, the key question is, having had a shallow downturn, how do we make sure that the upswing is long and stable and relatively free of major imbalances? That is, how do we make it like the last one? Well, at least part of the answer is that we'll need to reinvest in the same policy discipline, the same careful private sector management that paid dividends in the recent episode. That means keeping tested frameworks in place, amended if necessary in the light of experience. It means unwinding temporary measures as appropriate. It means keeping a focus on flexibility. And perhaps most of all, it means resisting the temptation to assume that prosperity is easily achieved or easily managed. So, in that spirit, let me offer three observations. Firstly, we start this upswing with less spare capacity than previous upswings. After a big recession, it usually takes some years of well above trend growth to eat into the spare capacity that the recession creates. This time, that process won't take as long. Most measures of capacity utilisation, unemployment, underemployment and so on, are much more like what we saw after the slowdown of 2001 than what we saw after the recession of 1990. Now, that's not a problem. Actually, it's good. It's a goal of economic policy to keep the economy not too far from full employment. And some spare capacity does exist, and it'll do so for a little while, which is why we still think that core inflation will probably come down a little more in the period just ahead. But it does underline the point that, or the importance, of adding to supply, not just to demand, over the medium term, and the importance of maximising the productivity of our factors of production if we're to have the sort of growth that genuinely brings prosperity. Secondly, in following on that theme of supply, others have noted, even today, I think, that the rate of population growth is now at its highest since the 1960s. On the one hand, that may alleviate certain labour constraints. On the other hand, immigrants need to live somewhere, they need to eat, and they need access to goods and services. That is, they add to demand as well as to supply. It follows that demand for additional dwellings, among other things, is likely to remain strong. Presumably, corresponding effects will flow onto urban infrastructure and so on. So the question of whether enough is being done on the supply side of housing is, I think, one that is going to remain on the agenda. Of course, it's true that adequate financial resources for housing will be needed. And in that regard, I think the current issue is not the cost of borrowing for the end buyers, which still remains quite low, but the availability in terms of credit for developers. Perceptions of by lenders of the riskiness of development in some cases are probably overdone a little just at the moment, given how strong the underlying fundamentals are on the demand side of the accommodation equation. That probably won't be a permanent problem, though. I suspect that the more persistent difficulties are going to be in the areas of supply, zoning, approval, and so on. Thirdly, the likely build-up in the resource sector in the next years carries significant implications for the medium-term performance and structure of the economy. Even if a number of the proposed projects don't go ahead, the ratio of mining investment to GDP in Australia, which is already very high, considerably higher than it's ever been before, will probably go even higher over the next several years. A sizeable share of the physical demand associated with that will be met from abroad through imported equipment, But the domestic spend will probably still be pretty significant. That is to say, other things equal, these trends are expansionary for the economy. The financial capital to fund this build-up will probably mostly come from abroad. That's to say that, absent some offsetting change somewhere else, Australia's current account deficit might well be considerably larger for some years than the 4 to 5% of GDP that we've seen in the past generation, which itself, of course, was considerably bigger than seen in the generation before that. Now, of course, the current account position we have had for that 25 years seems, to me anyway, to have turned out to be sustainable and manageable. It's been sustained for 25 years. So a temporarily larger one might well be sustainable as well, provided it involved a relatively modest amount of currency mismatch and a rise in investment rather than a reduction in saving, but that's what seems to be on the cards as we look ahead. In fact, I think one could argue that a temporarily pretty sizable current account deficit in some respects, if it's characterised by equity flows, might well be optimal in the sense that it would mean that a good deal of the risk of these projects is being shared with global investors. Why would Australia alone take on all the risks of these projects, which are very, very large? It probably makes sense to share the risk with global capital markets and global companies. But even if that is ideal, these trends will take some explaining, not least to foreign institutions and international organisations, many of whom have a rather more traditional view about current account positions. Our explanation of all this to our own citizens will also be important, and not just about capital flows. Over time, if the resource sector is to grow as a share of the economy, as seems likely, other areas by definition must shrink. That doesn't mean necessarily they shrink absolutely, because with population growth they might still, absolutely speaking, grow. But certainly as a share of the economy, they'll get smaller. So it follows that adjustment challenges will arise here. They'll have industry, geographic, social implications, and so on. Quite possibly the two-speed economy debate that we had a year or two back might end up being only a preview of what we could see if the resource sector build-up goes ahead. A further implication of all this could be that the economy's trade patterns end up being considerably less diversified, at least by destination and by commodity, than they've been in recent years. Now, such concentration wouldn't be unprecedented, and it might well be worth accepting if the returns from doing so are high enough, which it looks like they could well be. But we might also want to think about how to manage any risks associated with that concentration. Without question, the emergence of China and India, which in my view has a long way to go, is a great benefit potentially to Australia. But we have, along with that, a heightened exposure to anything that might go seriously wrong in those countries. So the question then would be how to manage an income flow over the long run which is higher on average, but possibly more volatile. The answer to that is beyond my brief either today or any other time, really, but it presumably involves thinking about both the extent and the form of saving by the community. Well, let me finish. As we look forward to a new expansion, we have, in my view, many advantages compared with other countries. The financial sector remains in good shape. The government does not own and has not had to give direct support to any financial institution. We will therefore be relatively, well, completely free of the very difficult governance and exit arrangements that these problems are already raising in other countries. public finances remain in good shape. There's a clear, credible path for the budget back to balance, and without the very large debt burdens that will inevitably narrow the options available to governments in other parts of the world. Sensible policy frameworks remain in place, macroeconomic and microeconomic, and they work. The financial regulatory system is strong and tested. We remain open for trade and investment. We have an exposure to Asia, which is still the part of the world where the growth potential in the next 40 or 50 years is greater than anywhere else. These advantages are already paying dividends. Properly exploited, they will pay many more. But there's no such thing as effortless or riskless prosperity. There's still a business cycle, and we do well to remember that, even if we've been spared the worst of the recent downturn. We'll need to continue investing in all the things that helped get us through the recent episode. And we'll need to accept and manage various challenges that will probably confront us in the years ahead. So the road to prosperity will have its bumps and its twists and turns. But it is the road to the right destination. Thank you very much for your attention.
As usual, Glenn has agreed to take some questions. And by convention, I think Alan Wood has the right to ask the first question.
Fire away, Alan.
In Perth recently, you were asked about the neutral rate of interest and what you thought it might be. You said then you'd like a bit more time to think about it. You've had a few weeks. Would you like to have a stab tonight?
Not enough time. Well, the neutral rate is, I think, a very useful analytical construct, rather like notions of the NARU, or natural rate of unemployment, output gaps, things like that. They're very useful analytical constructs. I think they're useful organising devices for thinking about policy. They're dangerous to put a precise figure on because there's no ABS statistic you can look up to see what the number is. So I can think of reasons why the natural rate might be lower in the future than in the past. For example, bank spreads between the cash rate and lending rates are higher than they used to be. If they stay there, then that may well mean that the so-called neutral cash rate is a bit lower than it used to be. If the economy's potential growth rate picks up, which could happen with the rate of investment we're doing and all this population growth, that actually is an argument for neutral to be higher. So there's a range of factors at work. What I did say is it was higher than we were then. It's probably still higher than where we are now, but the debate will be about how quickly we head in that direction, of course, about which I won't offer any remarks now, obviously.
Michael Stutchbury.
Thanks, Governor. You referred to the question of whether, particularly with an increased immigration intake, whether we'd run into capacity supply-side problems on the supply of housing. I think that's been one of the themes that has come out of today, both from people from the welfare sector who are worrying about without a supply of housing, increased supply of housing, rents will go up, and that's a problem for disadvantaged Australians. Mm. And it's also a problem on the macro management side of the economy that you're concerned with in terms of whether we're getting some sort of asset price problem and housing prices, which in part is related to restrictions on land release, which you referred to in your speech. Do you think there's an issue as to whether, and also the Treasurer raised it at his lunch today, with the as you did with the reduced supply of finance for multi-dwelling or for developers who are building flats and so forth. Do you think there's an issue that whether there's any one person that's really in really has responsibility for increasing the supply side of the housing industry. You've raised it; it seems to be a key issue for monetary policy going forward. But the responsibility for it seems to be split amongst, you know, many different parts of government. And I wonder if that's an issue for you.
Well, let me respond to a couple of pieces there. I mean, it's an issue for monetary policy in the sense that we observe housing prices rising. I'm not claiming that that's a bubble, so-called, and I haven't used that word, but it's part of the economy and one that we take note of because it has a number of macroeconomic implications. As to who's in charge, well, I'm not sure that there's any single person in charge. Possibly that's part of the problem, though I'm not sure that it would be that easy to put any single person in charge. I suppose my main point is simply that I don't actually think fundamentally in the ultimate analysis this is a monetary policy question. It's really a social question. It's a question of how is it that in a country this big in area and this small in numbers of people, we can't manage to make the marginal price of a dwelling lower than it is. It seems to me quite high. And the problem is not that there's not enough finance for housing. That actually, it's been a long time since that was a problem for the home buyer, and it isn't now. There is a temporary issue, I think, for development finance. My guess is that over the next year that will ease up. But the fundamental issue is how have we made the marginal cost of expanding the dwelling stock so high in a country this big? And I don't know what the answer is, but it presumably lies in that whole set of supply-side things that we've been talking about, over which, of course, I don't have any influence. But I think that's a very important economic and fundamentally social question. I haven't got the answer, though.
I'm sure by saying something about them you can have an influence, Governor. You underplay your strength. Bob Gregory.
Glenn, as you can imagine, we all read every speech that you make, and I thought tonight's was the best I've read since, or heard, since about 18 months ago when you talked about central bankers being more radical in terms of interventions. I want to make two comments, which you will probably find awkward. The first one is that if you go back 2 years ago, when inflation wasn't completely out of hand and the bank was tightening monetary policy, if you go back then, it seems to me you must be disappointed that we haven't had a bigger inflation dividend from this downturn. Now, normally you would expect inflation to come down much faster. And the second point I want to make is fairly serious. I've never heard a public official before raise the issue of whether we want to become so dependent on a narrow range of commodities and a particular set of countries. I mean, we've all talked about it at this conference as a good thing. You know, the growth of India, the growth of China in particular. Nobody sort of raised the issue of the dangers this might lead to. You, of course, said there'll be lots of positive plus, but you were the first person I've heard who's talked about maybe negative sides as well. And then I wondered what you had in mind when you said that, policy-wise, that is.
Well, on the inflation dividend, it's certainly true that inflation was way too high 2 years ago, which is why we were doing what we were doing at that time. Inflation comes down very quickly when you have a big recession. You know, if you think back to the early 90s, we got about 5-6 percentage points of, you know, steady state fall in the inflation rate. If we'd got that again now, then we would have got a lot more disinflation than we needed or wanted. It's a little early to judge, I think, whether we've got enough inflation dividend or whether the dividend, as you put it, is bigger or smaller than on other occasions. But I think, the 2001 slowdown, we got about a percentage point of disinflation. We need more than that this time because we're starting at about 4.5. We need to go to 2.5. But I think the cumulative period of spare capacity in the economy probably will be bigger this time than that time. So we still think that there's a bit more disinflation coming. But so I'm not ready to confess disappointment just yet, as you might think. But certainly I think the likelihood we're going to undershoot the target's gone away, and we'll need to keep an eye on the medium term. And that's, of course, part of the logic for our recent decisions. On the dependency point, I'm not saying that taking advantage of the Chinese emergence and so on is the wrong thing to do. I'm just, in a way, you can think of this as maybe like a financial portfolio decision. That's kind of an analogy. There's a very high return activity available, but very high returns typically come with risk, so you might think about how you manage the risk. So I'm not saying don't do it. I'm saying simply that if there's a high stream of income but potentially more variable, contingent on what might happen in those other countries, there may be a sort of long-run risk management thing to think about for the community. We don't have to solve that problem tonight or even in the next year, but it strikes me as a long-run issue that we might think about. So I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just pointing out a potential issue that in our potential euphoria, maybe, over all these gains that the country can make, and we should be happy about that, but there are things to manage as well. That's what I'm saying. Even apart from the two-speed economy issue.
I accept the analysis completely of the risk and so on. I'm just having trouble thinking about what policy responses one might introduce if you accepted that idea. I mean, suppose we accept that idea, what do we actually do?
Well, I don't want to get outside my field of responsibility here and get myself into trouble and create trouble for others, but if you've got a high but variable flow of foreign income, there are things countries do in managing that. Some countries take some of that income, put it offshore, and find a place to put it that's, inversely correlated to its source. Potentially, you could think about that. You could just think about saving more of it generally on the precautionary principle that it's more variable. So I think it goes to those sorts of issues, but they're not my... I shouldn't really say any more about that because I've probably already started hairs running in answering your question. There they go, yeah.
Let me say that some of those issues were touched on in the last session today, so the hairs have probably been started running by somebody else. Ross Garnaut on table one.
Glenn, over the last week or so, the chief executives of two of our four large commercial banks have commented that the bank's dependence on wholesale foreign borrowing is a point of vulnerability and we should seek to reduce it. Do you think that that is a point of vulnerability? Do you think that we should reduce it? And will there be a problem if, following the introduction of the guarantees on wholesale borrowing last October, the decision, there is an expectation within the financial system, in the private sector, that a government guarantee will be provided if in future there's problems in the banks rolling over their foreign liabilities?
Yeah, good questions. I think it's long been thought, actually, that the extent of wholesale funding offshore was a point of vulnerability. And indeed, 3 years ago, when the IMF came and did their FSAP, that was one of the issues on which they focused. And the scenarios that were worked through for that exercise at the time involved an Australian recession, a big fall in house prices, a big rise in unemployment, the currency came way down, and that funding got more difficult. And that work showed that the system would survive, albeit sustaining some losses. I think what we've lived through is, and I remember in that episode, there was a kind of extreme scenario where markets closed. And I remember saying to these people, well, what you're describing there would be a problem for Australia, but actually that kind of market closure globally is a huge problem for the world economy. That, in fact, is what we lived through a year ago. So we've had a real life stress test of the system, and I think it's pretty clear that the system's come through, you know, not without any problem, but actually it's come through very well. Now, it's true, as you say, that the guarantee was given, and it had to be by a whole range of countries, given the state of the market panic that was in place at the time. I myself think we're getting pretty close to not needing it. I think many of the banks in the past month, most of their issuance has been unguaranteed, even offshore. So it will be able to pass from the scene before much longer, I think. The question you raise of moral hazard, it's the big question. I mean, the truth is that globally, not just in Australia, there is massive moral hazard as a result of this episode. I think that's inevitable if you, as a policymaker, do the things you have to do to stop the system going over the edge. So how do we handle that in the future? Well, that's the $64 billion question. I don't have the answer. It's tied up with, of course, the question of too big to fail, which is the main intractable global question that most of my counterparts are trying to grapple with. And so I think these questions of moral hazard remain with us for a long time, and they will remain until the day when, in some future period of financial stress, somebody somewhere in the world is prepared to let an institution fail and has the confidence to do that because they know the system won't crash around them if they do. We're some way away from that being possible, I think, at the moment in the developed countries. But that's ultimately, to get rid of the moral hazard, you have to get back to institutions being able to fail.
Thank you, Chair. Governor Bill Baxter, a farmer and former National Party state MP, I was very interested in your comments about capacity as we go on the road to recovery. And I just want to relate perhaps something that's a personal matter, but I bank with one of the big four. They've just advised me that they're more than doubling the cost of my overdraft accommodation. When I tackled them about that yesterday, they blame APRA and say, well, this is a requirement being placed on them. I'm very sceptical about that, of course, because I know they just abolished fees on some of the incompetents who run personal accounts and can't run them properly, and I think they're recovering it from the rest of us. But my issue is this where we're getting into trouble with people protecting their behinds by putting in regulations which are really going to hinder our capacity in the future to really make this recovery sustainable?
Well, I'm not sure that I would jump to blame APRA for higher risk margins on loans to farmers. I've not heard of them dictating that at all. But the broader question you raise of how the regulatory structure internationally evolves is a very important one. There's no doubt that the regulatory community, under a fair bit of pressure from leaders of G20 countries, is looking to go to a world where all banks hold some more capital, where very large, systemically important banks maybe even hold a bit more, or even a lot more again, where there is more focus on managing liquidity risk, because I think one of the lessons was 20 years of focusing on capital requirements is what was all fine, but liquidity management got a little left out of the regulatory equation, and then Northern Rock occurred, and that focused the mind on that. So liquidity. There's also a proposal which will get up in some form, I think, to have a leverage ratio. Now, actually, Basel II is a leverage ratio, but what's being talked about in addition to that is a very simple capital to total assets ratio. All these ideas are okay, they're fine in their own right, but we do need to be careful that in the work that now has to be done over the next year or more to assess the quantification, the parameterization, if you like, of how we set these numbers, that we do that carefully. After all, the big problems in the global system were really the result of the actions of 30 or 40 very large, highly risk-taking international institutions, none of them in this country. And the regulatory changes which are being proposed are aimed at curtailing that behaviour in the future. Now, that's fine. We just need to make sure that the thousands of other banks in the world who came through fine and who are not therefore demonstrably seriously undercapitalised, I wouldn't have thought, that we don't inadvertently constrain their capacity to do their job. So what's needed for that is for the technicians to be given the time to make sure that the structures that are put in place and the numbers we choose for our leverage ratios, etc., are the right ones, and we don't end up shooting ourselves in the foot with a rushed and ill-considered decision. Now, that can be done, it just takes time. So there's a huge amount of regulatory work being done, and we see a bit more of it now because we're on the Basel Committee of Banking Supervision now, and they're quite complex issues, but I think what I could say is that the Australian side, ourselves and APRA, are very cognizant of the need to not overdo, slam various barn doors when it's way too late and overdo regulatory changes.